Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning, and welcome to another episode of What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Today, we are joined by Carolyn Kirkwood of Kirkwood Therapy. She'll be on a little later to share her journey into the mental health field. We'll also hear from Andrew DeMonte of Cooperation Buffalo and Tara Dumas of Farmer Pirates Compost. They joined Jay Moran to talk about their partnership and how both organizations are making an impact in Buffalo. But first, if you tuned in last Monday, you know we toured Providence Farm Collective. As promised, we continue that tour on today's episode. For that, here's Jay Moran.
Recently, What's Next visited the Providence Farm Collective in Orchard Park to get a look at their newest addition. Following a capital campaign, a multi-use building was erected, which now houses a farm store, offices, storage space, and most important, a washing area.
So this is the new washing
area. Oh, wow.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, see? Like, we really wanted you to see this. That's why I wanted to have you back. So, hey, Oro, sorry. So there are like 20 people who can work here at a time now.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah.
So where's what you were waiting in line to use it before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
And
wow.
We're building cold storage here in the next couple of months. So we'll have two units. So that's really cool. Hey, how are you, Oma? And then we'll show you some of the rest of the place.
All right. Oh, nice.
So this is a meeting space, but also probably onion and garlic storage in the winter. We've been doing farmland access strategic planning to make sure that incubator program is figuring out, like, how we help people launch who want to launch. So we have a group of farmers from the Burundian and the Congolese community. They've been meeting. We've brought in Cooperation Buffalo because they're interested in forming a farm co-op. We have other folks who just want to be, you know, solo farmers. And so we're trying to identify at what point during our educational programming do we build in financing, identifying land, how do you afford that land? So making that plan. So this is really exciting. We plan on being done with this December-ish, and we'll share it widely because there's like 2 million acres of farmland in transition just in New York State over the next 10 years, and that has no plan for it. So to be able to build those connections between those retiring farmers and emerging farmers and identify, like, viability in people taking on that land is just really important across the state. So, and that's actually happening across the country. A lot of people don't realize that farming is in peril. Farmland is in peril, and we really need to worry about that.
Right.
So, and then Hamadi will take you down our gallery.
All right.
There's have bathrooms now.
Oh, those are helpful, right?
Oh, yes.
Right. This time, just for simplicity, I'll lead a walkthrough first, yes.
And
got all beautiful pictures here, our gallery.
Right.
And all the farmers, our farmers market there, and various farmers and awards that we have been receiving through
our
oil formation here.
Wow, okay. So I just saw Patrick Gallivan's name on one. I mean, so you're getting, do you feel like you're getting bipartisan support? I mean,
we have gotten bipartisan support. Yeah.
Wow, we found the one institution.
Yes.
It's actually getting bipartisan support.
So, yeah, it's, well, interestingly enough, we certainly struggle with certain representatives, and as a result of that, don't have a voice, and that's kind of hard. But we do have Lindsay Larigo sent, congratulations. We have Senator Gallivan, who loves coming out here. So it's been really nice that way.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you've come a long way.
We have. Well, check out these offices. So.
Oh, wow. Again, a little different than high.
So much better. Yeah. So, that we don't have to wear snow clothes to work anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Got birds flying overhead. We have two little meeting rooms now.
Okay. Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Isn't this cool?
It's totally cool. When did this opening up?
We got in here in January.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, so I always say that this capital campaign, first of all, we raised $2.5 million in a year. Secondly, with that $2.5 million, we bought this land, so we own it. We built this barn. We started a small farmer-directed endowment fund at the Community Foundation. We also are protecting this land as farmland forever. But most importantly, every year on this land, there are 200-plus people growing food, feeding 14,000 Western New Yorkers, and they are increasing their own incomes in doing so. And I just think that that's, such an important piece of what we do, is that, bigger investment of building community connection, but that multiplier effect of, $2.5 million is not a huge capital campaign, but the widespread impact of it in Western New York, it's pretty incredible. So, yeah, so we're grateful for all the folks who've invested in this community, who are part of this community, because it has impact.
Nice. Very good. Very good. Well, must be nice to have an office.
Oh, so nice. Then back here, we used to be under basically a circus tent.
That's right. That's right.
And now it was about a third of this size. This is where we gather now.
Oh.
We have lunch here every, 6 days a week it was this year. It's usually 5 days a week, and everybody comes together, and it's a farm-to-table, cultural lunch. And this is a trailer that the Bills helped us get several years ago when we moved here to make sure our lunch program would be viable. And that has been a wonderful thing to build community, because it's actually when you come together for a meal, you find out how much you really have in common with people. Yeah, so.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, is it safe to say that every section of this farmland is being farmed right now?
Yeah. So much so that we have leased 3 acres from Cornell Cooperative. They own 15 acres next to us. Mm. And to keep the incubator going, we leased 3 acres. And we also, within that, that's where that land access plan comes into play, because it's just so important to be able to launch people. It's not that we want to grow bigger here. It's really that we want here to reverberate out and build out. And I think that that's a really important part of that. And then we have actually waiting lists for the incubator program, for the community farm program. We have 8 community farms here. We have 6 communities on the list. So the need is still really high. But helping people to launch will be a really important part of it all.
And not to take away from just a lovely tour here and very optimistic thoughts, but what's the biggest obstacle moving forward?
The breaking of the social contract, right? So I think of the fact that, you know, 100 years ago, the idea of a nonprofit was formed with this promise and idea that government, corporate America, philanthropy would be equal partners in supporting innovation, grassroots innovation for people to meet needs in a community. Well, when government steps out of that, when philanthropy is limited in our region, especially resource-wise, and when also everybody's confused, like, we have high need in Western New York, who are we going to save? That's a threat to us all. And that's where I encourage all of us in Western New York to come together, support any nonprofit, but support it completely. You know, believe in it, invest in it, become a monthly recurring donor. It's just so important for us all to, you know, moving forward, because who knows, is this going to be a lasting thing? I don't know, but I know that that contract right now is broken, and I don't know that we bring it back.
Well, that's not necessarily the most optimistic way to finish, but that's good. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's truth, and I think people get afraid, but I also think on our end, we bring people together to think through these things together and to work together and support each other. So there's the optimism. We come here every day so full of hope.
Like Grace said, it's the place to come for your mental health.
Yeah. Well, I think of those legacy farmers. They know the reality and the hardship of what they do every day, yet they do it year after year, generation after generation. That's our farmers, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, very good. Well, yeah. Geez, great tour. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys could come.
Oh, yes.
That's Kristen Heltman-Wise, Executive Director of the Providence Farm Collective, during our recent visit to their Orchard Park location. Kristen and Deputy Executive Director Hamadi Ali returned the favor by dropping into our What's Next studios for a longer conversation. Among the topics, a status report on a federal grant that was taken away from Providence Farm Collective. Then, after a lawsuit was filed, the funding was returned, a situation which may not be permanent. A lot's been happening. Last time we had you guys in studio was just after some tremendously bad news from the federal government. So I think we're going back now. I'll let you maybe set the timetable for us. But this was word from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that they were going to rescind funding from you. Give us the details of how that emerged.
So on April 25th, we received a letter saying that our Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Development Program grant was being terminated. We were mid-grant, a second, actually three-year cycle of funding that we had received for that. And it was really shocking to us because it wasn't even 6 months earlier when we were invited by the USDA to participate in a conference presenting our project, our incubator farm project, as it was actually being upheld as, you know, one of the more successful projects across the country. So to receive that letter, and then it said in the letter that our funding was being terminated because we were in violation of civil rights law with DEI programming that was against, like, the current administration's priorities. And so that was really hard because we were just launching the season, and our incubator farm program is unique in Western New York. We train beginning farmers, new entry farmers through a three-year program how to farm in Western New York with a goal of launching them to their own farm businesses. This year, we have 23 incubator farms, and we also have a waiting list for people who want to do this program. So the idea of going into the season, not having the resources to do this was very worrisome.
but also the added stress of, you know, the farm season is a ton of work. And now we have to figure out, okay, how do we appeal this? Do we file a lawsuit? All of those other things. So it was definitely a challenge.
And just to update, you've appealed.
Yes.
You are currently in possession of the funding.
Yes.
But there's a big but here, right?
Yes.
You expect it to be rescinded.
Yes. So what happened was we actually became part of a national lawsuit. We're represented by Farm Stand, Farmer Justice Center, and Earth Justice in the DC District Court. And we had filed a motion for a preliminary injunction, which was granted by the judge, where we had our funding restored until the case goes through the entire lawsuit. Now, the actual hearing date has not been set. It took about a month. We did get the funding back, but we don't really expect to win this case. In all likelihood, the way that things are going, we anticipate perhaps winning the case in the DC District Court, but also if it goes to the Supreme Court, losing it, just because of how they've ruled so far in these instances. So, you know, what do you do? Do you spend that money? Well, we have to do the programming,
right?
But we also have to figure out how we're going to make up that money. So that's where we're at right now.
Right. So in essence, you may have to pay back anything that you spend from that funding.
Absolutely.
Allocation.
Yeah,
to show how difficult this scenario has really become.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, right now we're actually doing three different budgets for next year. We're trying to figure out worst case scenario, likely scenario, and dream scenario. And in all likelihood, and in worst case scenario, we will have to pay back those funds. It would be the dream case scenario that we would be allowed to keep that funding.
Let's talk about the Providence Farm Collective. We have to, of course, acknowledge the reality of the news and most certainly the serious nature of it. But at the same time, the Providence Farm Collective has been there. And I don't necessarily see it going away anytime soon. So, Hamadi, let's talk about the incubator program, okay? What exactly do we mean by this?
So, the incubator program, it is a program that takes individuals for 3 years, trains them how to farm. Mm-hmm. Not that the individuals don't know how to farm. They come from farming background, but the U.S. environment being different from where the farmers come from. So
the majority of whom are from Africa.
Africa, yes. Mm-hmm. So PFC kind of becomes a medium to train the farmers. And also there is the business aspect of farming, which also PFC trains the farmers how to run a farm business. So that's the incubator program.
So take me then, if we don't mind, just touching on your personal journey just a little bit, okay?
Sure.
Okay, I think pretty much everybody who hears your amazing and beautiful voice knows that you're not from Buffalo. Where are you from originally?
I am originally from Somalia.
Okay. Had a farming background in Somalia?
Yes.
Okay.
So the Somali Bantus are from southern Somalia, and they are known as farmers.
Okay.
When the Somali Civil War broke out, majority of the Somali Bantus fled into Kenya. While in Kenya, they also continued with their farming background minimally. And in 2003, a lot of the Bantus start coming to the U.S. My family, fortunately, was resettled here in Buffalo in 2004.
Okay.
And as soon as my family and the community, the Somali Bantu community, came here to Buffalo, realized that, okay, this could be the place for us, but it is not. We are...
Because you were settled probably in the city.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyone familiar with Buffalo, my family was right next to Lanova Pizzeria on West Ferry.
West Ferry Street, yes.
So that's where it all began, actually. My family had a backyard garden growing veggies, and some of the Somali Banta community members came to see that. And, you know, the conversation going like, okay, this could be the place, but it's not what we are used to.
we are farmers. How do we get back to our, you know, roots? So we created Somali Bantu Community Organization of Buffalo, and on the get-go, the community start approaching people that we thought could help us to get land to farm.
Your backyard wasn't going to be enough.
It wasn't going to be enough. It was barely enough for our family, a family of eight. Yes. So what the community did, went around for 10 years approaching anybody. There was what I call, and anyone else probably call, the respectful or the polite yes. Someone will help, but no one ever helped. In 2015 or 16, we met with Christine, who volunteered at our community and also was a board member for the Somali Bantu Community Organization. So Christine sees many needs, but couldn't pinpoint to one. So she ended up asking friends. She always calls us friends. How can I help? And Christine invited us to her house for potluck with a lot of her friends. And we told her, we need farmland. We come from a group of people who always have farmed. Farming is all we know. How do we get back to our roots? And Kristen said, I'm not promising anything, but I will see what I can do.
Okay. And that has brought us to where we are now.
Yes.
On Burton Road in Orchard Park.
Exactly. It started on Homewood in East Aurora, as the Somali Bantu Community Farm. But just like my family began a backyard garden and the Somali Bantu started their community farm, there were other communities that were looking for farmland, just like the Bantus, and start coming out like, hey, how do we become like the Bantus, get the land? And that's how Providence Farm Collective now came to being.
Gotcha.
You know, as an umbrella organization to oversee all of these communities. Yes.
And how many communities do we have now at Providence Farm Collective? It seems like there's always somebody new out there. What do we add? I see both of you are kind of like, I'm not really sure.
Nine or 10.
We have, I think 10 communities, and we can count and see.
Sure.
We have the Somali Bantus.
Okay.
We have the Burundis,
mm-hmm.
Congolese, Liberians, Ethiopians. We have a Vietnamese.
Okay.
Buffalo Go Green, African-American.
American.
Sure.
The Karani community.
Burmese.
The Burmese community. And a Bengali community. So we have 10.
10.
Yes.
Wow. So you said one of the things that you mentioned is, all right, so you farmed in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're farming in Western New York. Providence Farm Collective has been able to find some land for you to farm on, but just talk about the culture shock of trying to farm in this climate, this type of soil, as compared to what you're accustomed to.
Completely different.
Okay.
You have frost here.
Yes, we do.
Never have frost in Somalia, Kenya, or anywhere. Yeah.
Okay.
So trying to simply tell someone you can't grow these past this time, some folks don't understand you. I had someone just planting okra like 3-4 weeks ago, and I'm like, no, you are not going to get a harvest out of this. Do not plant it. You can easily plant salad mix. You'll get about 3 harvests from it. So to a typical American, that might seem simple. To someone who just have arrived in the country, you have to show them the way. Yeah, and PFC is the medium that, you know, shows these farmers. If I simply went into farming myself, I probably could have grown things that I shouldn't have grown here. I've seen folks who try to grow cassava here.
Okay.
Yes. And when you tell them, okay, the soil is not fit for what you're planting, and also the climate, the weather, is way different. You're not going to be successful. But when PFC comes in the middle and trains the farmers, farmers get it.
Sure.
Yeah. They start understanding, okay, so this is what I can grow. This is how I should do it. And this is the way to go.
I want to get into food security being part of this. And I think I'll bring Kristen in for that. But before I do that, I want to just ask this final question. And I'm going to ask you to not only speak for yourself, but perhaps for other people who are out farming at Providence Farm Collective. Beyond food security, beyond being able to grow your own fresh food and bring it home, is there something more to it? Or maybe I'm going to use the word spiritual, but a connection that's important to the people who come to farm there?
Yes. So we have many people, but yes, one particular individual, Mr. Kandolo Makongo, who's originally from the Congo, DRC.
Okay.
And he lived in Tanzania. He was a small-scale farmer in Tanzania and also worked as a trainer, training other farmers. And when he came to the States, he was sent to work at a factory. That wasn't his dream. When he found PFC, he felt like God has answered his prayers. You know, start farming at a PFC as an incubator farmer. And this year launched his farm in East Buffalo on Peckham Street, about an acre.
Okay.
He's farming there. And whenever you ask Mr. Kandolo, he tells you, I want to leave a legacy to my kids.
Wow.
To know where they came from.
And now it's on Peckham Street.
Now it's on Peckham
Street. On the east side.
In the east side, yes.
Wow. Well, I guess the Providence Farm Collective, the name has a lot of meanings to it, doesn't it? Our guest this morning from the Providence Farm Collective, Hamadi Ali, Deputy Director, Executive Director, Kristen Heltman Wise. So, Kristen, let's talk about that food security portion of this, for lack of a better term. Just a few months ago, before administrations changed in Washington, that was a major issue. I mean, we obviously heard about it after 514, you know, food desert, food apartheid was the term that many used, that there just isn't enough fresh food around. Providence Farm Collective looks to address that.
We do. So we do that in many ways. And what's interesting is our mission itself has these two arms. One is addressing food security through our community farms where people volunteer. They drive out to Orchard Park from the city between jobs and family obligations to grow food to feed their families, their communities, and others across Western New York. And then we have the incubator farm program, and that's empowering people to start farm businesses and access farmland. And both are needed across Western New York. I think about the impact that the community farms and the incubator farms have had on the region. Providence Farm Collective, year after year, our farms produce over 100,000 pounds of produce, feeding over 14,000 people. And many of those people actually get their food through food pantries that we donate to. And we did that through a program that Hamadi started several years ago, but actually had the idea for 8 years ago, which is our Produce Aggregation for Food Pantries program. So that's where Providence Farm Collective raises money to buy from our farmers at fair wholesale prices food that they grow. We aggregate it and then we donate it. This year it's to 15 different food pantries. And what's beautiful about that program is it honors both the work of farmers, because a lot of times food pantries will rely on donations from farmers, and no farmer can afford to donate food. Farmers live within very tight margins, and to be paid and to be paid parity pricing for what they grow is really important, because the other important thing about all farmers is they do this work year after year, even though it's really, really hard, because they care about community and they care about feeding people. So I love that program because it honors both of those things. And Hamadi, at the beginning of the program, actually reached out to the food pantries to find out who's your customer, to identify what cultural foods were important. When you speak about like farm and food being spiritual, it's that idea. Our traditions, our connections with families, our celebrations are so much a part of food and cooking together.
Right.
And so Hamadi learned that at certain food pantries, it served a specific demographic who wanted specific kinds of produce, and he makes sure that each customer receives that food, and it's just harvested food. So when you look at our delivery truck, you'll see on the side it says food with dignity, and that's foremost what we're about. And I think that that's really important to understand too.
This is going to get into one of those opinion type of questions here, but I'm just going to ask you this. Before you got into the Providence Farm Collective, before you have you worked with the Somali Bantu community, obviously, but to me, what has become just an incredible eye-opener is the amount of need for food. And we're not just talking culturally sensitive. We're talking about food in general here in Western New York. How about for you? Did you kind of go through the same thing? Are you seeing a situation that is A, both very, very difficult to contend with, but B, maybe that is still not really well understood?
Yes. So I live in East Aurora, and in general, it's not that there isn't need in East Aurora. There is, but it's hidden. And it's more obvious in certain parts of rural Western New York and in the city of Buffalo, city of Lockport, city of Batavia. Like, you see it more so in certain neighborhoods, especially. And I think a lot of that goes to, you know, we're still a very segregated region economically and racially. And so for a lot of people, they don't know what they don't see,
right?
You know, and if you don't see it, you don't understand it. And so, yeah, there is huge need here. And I think that's really an interesting part about how our farmers market started. It was Hamadi reaching out to our farmers. Well, actually, our farmers asking him, we need our own farmers market. And he said, oh, okay, to sell your produce. And they said, no, also to feed our community, by us and for us, because it's our farmers identifying this need directly within their communities and then meeting that need.
So the farmers market, year number three for the farmers market?
Four. Yes.
Grant Street,
130 Grant Street.
Every Saturday?
Every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
What's different about your farmers market?
The difference, you can find almost every veggie that you can find anywhere in the world. That might be an exaggeration, but
yeah. But you're going to find a lot that you're not going to see in the biggest supermarkets,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We have Malabar spinach. I bet you can't find it anywhere in Buffalo, but at Providence Farm Collective International Farmers Market.
And it's grown in Orchard Park?
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing. I want to get back to Providence Farm Collective. People haven't seen it. It's on Burton Road in Orchard Park, and I'll state because of the many times now I've been lost going out there. It's not in the South Burton Road. It's on the North Burton Road, right? Off of Newton, right? Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So we got that part going, right? But here's the thing. There is now a beautiful new barn there that wasn't there when I first visited. You've got new tools to work with. Tell me about your new tools that you have out of the Providence Farm Collective, including what's inside that barn.
Yes. So the barn contains a farm store, a wash and pack station, two bathrooms, an office, and a commercial kitchen. I think I got it.
You did. You got it.
Yes. Every aspect of the barn is my favorite, but I have the most favorite, the wash and pack station.
Yes.
So before our new barn, we had the old barn, and the wash and pack station could the most accommodate three, if you push four farmers to wash and pack their produce. We have about 21 incubator farmers. On Fridays, where mostly our farmers come to harvest to sell to PFC and take the next day to take to the farmers market, it was a hustle.
Right.
The new wash and pack station could easily accommodate about 20 farmers harvesting, washing, and packing their produce. So it has increased our efficiency. And I think, as Kristen said, has allowed our farmers to work more on their plots than to house or to wash and pack.
So it's increased efficiency, it's increased output as well. Okay. So, Kristen, a great example of the people who invested in your capital campaign. This is the fruit, literally the fruits of that particular effort.
Absolutely. I think what an incredible investment that our community made in that capital campaign. So $2.5 million was raised. That money was spent, it purchased our land, so we own the land. It built the barn. We started a small farmer-directed endowment fund at the Community Foundation, and we're protecting that land forever as agriculture. So it will always be farmland. I think most impactful is what it gives back year after year. Every year, over 100,000 pounds of produce is grown, feeding 14,000 Western New Yorkers, providing access to 200-plus farmers. And I just think of like what that impact is year after year on our local economy, feeding people, taking care of people, offering farmland, just even the work that we do to share with the greater community the importance of agriculture in our region, the importance of supporting your local farmer. Buy directly from your farmer. It's the best thing you can do economically. And making that community connection. So yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Cooperation Buffalo helps workers gain economic security through cooperative business ownership, building wealth and power in communities most affected by inequality. They have partnered with Farmer Pirates Compost, a Buffalo-based worker-owned cooperative that turns food scraps into nutrient-rich compost. Andrew and Tara speak with Jay about what makes their partnership and both organizations thrive.
We're talking about co-ops, cooperative businesses, with us Executive Director from Cooperation Buffalo, Andrew Del Monte, and Tara Dumas of Farmer Pirates Compost. I'll say the full name instead of shorthanding it. Andrew, of course, a return guest here on What's Next, but the first chance we've had to talk with Tara and about Farmer Pirates. And I said this during the break. I mean, I'm like starstruck to have you here with us, because when I first heard about your business, whenever many years ago, I was totally fascinated by the concept. So let's talk about Farmer Pirates. What is Farmer Pirates?
So we're a small local business that is working really hard to keep food scraps out of the landfill and turn them into a really valuable resource, which is compost,
right,
a nutrient-rich fertilizer that can be used to revitalize and replenish soils all over our area to grow flowers, vegetables, you know, whatever it is you want, but really just like create this circular sort of system.
And you told me before we went on the air, that last year, and you—I mean, though you're a growing business and you've expanded your base here, you're pretty small when it comes right down to it, and yet you were able to collect 1.2 million,
1.4 million,
1.4 million pounds of food scraps last year, and turn them into compost.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If you, I mean, that's. That's just a drop in the bucket. If you think about, you know, how like that volume of food scraps that would otherwise just be going to sit into a landfill, it's mind boggling, really. We do know that food scraps make up the fourth largest item that enter, you know, municipal landfills. So keeping those food scraps out of the landfill really can have a major impact.
How did this all come about for you? I get the feeling this is a great story.
Yeah, I mean, so back in 2012, there was a group of us that got together and actually formed Farmer Pirates Cooperative.
Okay.
And we were just a group of people that were growing food in Buffalo or wanted to grow food. We were, you know, urban farmers or community gardeners, and we just wanted to kind of form a group where we could help each other out, buy seeds together, share knowledge, share tools, buy land together. So we did that. And the first thing that we, you know, really noticed was that wow, this soil here in the city, it's pretty rough. We need compost. We need a natural fertilizer to revitalize these, you know, poor soils. And so we were trucking like composted horse manure, cow manure in from rural areas. And it was expensive and not super great. And, you know, at that time, there were other organizations around the country that were collecting food scraps and turning them into compost. And so we ran a small Kickstarter campaign to get this off the ground. Mm-hmm. And we started with about 20 customers that we, you know, we gave used buckets to collect their food scraps. We came by and picked them up. And then we started, you know, composting with pitchforks, you know, by hand. Just we got a connection with the Buffalo Equestrian Center. Mm. They had all this horse bedding that they were having trucked out of the city into a rural area. And so we said, will you bring it to us instead? Mm-hmm. We'll take it for free. You have to drive a lot less distance. We know we'll process it right here. And so we started mixing the food scraps with the horse bedding by hand and using that compost on our farms and gardens at that time. And so obviously more than 10 years later, it's grown into a different thing. I'm no longer an urban farmer. And, you know, I'm not using the sole purpose isn't anymore to create compost for myself. It's grown into something so much bigger than that.
Finally, Carolyn Kirkwood of Kirkwood Therapy, as she shares what inspires her to help others. This is a preview of a conversation that will air in full at a later date.
Carolyn, it's interesting. I want to get to your background story just a little bit. You told me this before we went on the air. You set out to be a teacher like so many of us. What a funny thing happened on the way to becoming a teacher. What happened to you, Carolyn?
So I thought I wanted to be a teacher. I love little kids. And I went to school for teaching and I went through all the classes. And when I got to the end to do the student teaching, I realized, no, thank you. Mm. It was not what I wanted to do. And I didn't find the most joy in it because I realized at the time that I had a lot of empathy and sympathy for the kids.
Right.
I was working at a school in the Black community, neighborhood school. All the kids kind of like walked to school and stuff. And the kids would come with no food and didn't have the uniform and things like that. So I felt myself more connected to that side of it than the education side of it. But I still didn't realize that it was social work just yet. A few years later, I became a foster parent. Mm. And being a foster parent, I adored it so much that one of my foster kids, I adopted. So one of the four children that I have is adopted. And while I fostered 17 kids.
Fostered 17 kids.
Yeah, yeah. I loved it. And throughout that time, I felt myself really connected to the story of the child, the background of this child, and really working with parents.
Right.
I met different parents who had fallen on hard times, of course, considering that the child was in foster care with me. And I just had a natural connection to encouraging parents and just kind of helping work through different challenges with them so that they can just regain custody of their child, working on different parenting skills and just mental health. All the things that are connected with a child being in foster care. And then that was when I realized that it was social work that was, you know, in my core, that was my background, that was where I needed to be. And so I did finish the bachelor's degree because I was already at the tail end of it. And then when I went back for my master's, that's when I started the social work career. And now here I am.
Here you are with your own practice, yeah. That's for sure. But we've had a couple of programs on foster care before. And since you brought it up, and if you don't mind, maybe if we could just explore your experience mm-hmm. just a little bit more. 17 kids.
Yeah.
And it must, I hate to use the term break your heart, but to know that there are so many kids mm-hmm. who are waiting mm-hmm. for foster help. Well, let's just talk about maybe that as well. You obviously loved it mm-hmm. and love it. 17 kids. What did you love about it that struck you to the point where you made that kind of commitment?
So one, I love children, which is why I thought I wanted to be a teacher.
Sure.
So I'm a natural nurturer. So it's natural for me to love and care for a child. So that was the thing. But then a lot of the kids that I had were children of color, children from BIPOC families. And I just, had a different experience. I won't say that I was heartbroken. I was excited to have an opportunity to offer love and a safe home to these children. Mm-hmm. Because I've heard so many stories of how not so fun foster care can be, not so safe, not so loving for kids who are already falling on hard times.
Yeah.
And in my core, I wanted to make a difference. Mm. And it was natural and easy for me to make a difference because I'm a loving person and I have food, you know? So
you'd like to think that there are millions of people who fall under that category, but, but the foster people would tell you otherwise.
Yeah, but it truly came easy and natural, like completely effortless for me to take another child in and offer them love, a safe home, and three meals a day and snacks.
Right. You know? What do you think makes a difference? Like you said, you know, you thought, you know, you just laid it out. I can love, and I got food in my house. That's all that's needed. Yet most people do not, you know, open up their homes to foster care. I guess, can you again maybe make a comparison to what you see the failings are in other circumstances? Again, I hate to focus on the negative, but, you know, there's a lot of
issues
there.
People do fall on hard times.
Yeah.
And I truly believe, and from what I've seen, is that mental health is usually the biggest barrier to families. And when your mental health is less well, you can't be your best self. You can't be your best parent. You can't be your best wife. You can't be your best whatever you are, whether you're a bus driver, a nurse, you know, a waitress. You can't be your best self if your mental health is less well.
Right.
And so that is what really drew me closer to the mental health field, because I saw a reoccurring theme of the parent is in a domestic violence situation, or they have different mental health challenges where they can't be present. They're not working, so they can't provide the food for their child, or, you know, whatever the situation is. And it's usually, it always turns back to the mental health of the parent, which causes the disruption in the home and lands the child in foster care. But then it creates a repeating cycle, because now this child is dealing with separation anxiety and abandonment issues. So now their mental health is less well. And so it builds that cycle of now the parent was less well. So now the child is less well. And now, you know, it just kind of goes around and around and around. And so I really love being the chain breaker there, you know, and kind of ending that generational cycle to where now this child is in my home. We're going to get counseling. We're going to be, you know, constantly doing group therapy and giving them love and just kind of showing them a new way of life while the parent is also working on themselves, you know?
Absolutely. And thank you for doing that. And thanks to anybody who continues to be a foster parent. Seriously. I mean, when you really get right down to it, what a huge service to society it is. I mean, there's no other way of looking at it because, you know, kids are so, I mean, again, I don't want you to necessarily breach privacy here, but can you talk about maybe like a circumstance that when you think about one of those foster kids that came through your house that, this kid was really up against it.
So I had a foster child who I believe just never stood a chance because their mom was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And so before this particular child was born, the older sibling was born. The older sibling was born and addicted to cocaine. So right from the hospital, that child was placed into foster care. And what was troublesome to me is that the mom never stopped using. And so she never got the help that she needed. So when she had the second child, which was the foster child that came to stay with me, this child was also born addicted to cocaine and alcohol. The child was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. And it's just very troublesome and very sad because this baby was born into this, didn't ask to be here, never had a chance, you know, because of the decisions of mom, because mom was not well.
And right.
She never got the support that she needed. So she's continuing to have these children that are born with challenges, you know?
Sure.
And so that child just really, really had a special place in my heart. So it was situations like that, that really, you know, and it gave me the fuel to just keep doing the work, you know, keep offering the children love.
Sure. And you also talk about your interactions with the parents, the biological parents as well. Talk a little bit, again, maybe give us a little insight into how that worked for you, how maybe you handled it, maybe, because it sounds like for you, this all works out very well. You mm-hmm. could handle it. And mm-hmm. but yeah, I've met, you know, foster parents who, you know, they couldn't get through those mm-hmm. those mm-hmm. Those stressors. So what
I
about
think that?
That
has a lot to do with why I started my private practice, Kirkwood Therapy,
sure.
is because those parents needed the support. They needed someone that can understand their perception and that is unbiased and non-judgmental to kind of talk to. So like that particular parent, we talked about like using drugs and stuff. And because I'm not Child Protective Services,
right.
she felt more comfortable talking to me about it or being open and honest about it. And it was really those conversations that really drew out that side of me where I realized like, I can do this, you know,
yeah.
and it's needed to really become a therapist, to like really be doing this work every day with people, having these conversations every day with people. And we had a conversation one time and she was just saying how like, I want to go to treatment, but I don't want to look like a bad person or a bad mom. And she just felt, she felt stuck because there's a stigma against going to treatment and getting the support that you need. And, you know, you do have to be away from your children to go to inpatient and get the support. And so she really just needed a lot of encouragement. And I told her, I said, listen, nobody is judging you. We all fall on hard times here, you know. And I talked to her about, you actually look much better as a parent by letting your child go to foster care so that you can get the support that you need, you know, really focusing on yourself and just trusting that your child is in a safe space and that while your child is safe, that you can go and get the support that you need. So that way, when you come back together, you both are in a much better place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And boy, you really are taking me down, I think, a fascinating road of understanding some life situations that a lot of people don't experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about that, just like you said, that stigma of going to treatment. I can certainly appreciate that. And I guess what I'm wondering from you, now that you are in your own practice,
mm-hmm.
you have these interactions in your home with a biological parent as a foster parent,
yeah.
but do you have an understanding of why that stigma is there and you know, what we could do maybe to break that down a little bit and try to, you know, give the kind of support that's needed? Because it's really unfortunate that, you know, somebody feels that they can't go get the treatment that they need
yeah.
because there's something there that's blocking.
I think that the stigma is there for different reasons.
Okay.
But one reason that I can pull out is that for a long time, mental health was such a taboo topic. And not only was it a taboo topic, it was almost like it was frowned upon. Like if you were to admit that you were struggling with anxiety and depression, you were air quote crazy.
Right.
Or, you know, you were admitted into an intensive, you know, rehab program or something like that. And so because of that, people are afraid that I don't want to lose my kids just because I'm admitting that I'm struggling with depression. I don't want to be admitted to an inpatient rehab because I have a little bit of anxiety. And so people just don't say anything. They do nothing about it. They keep it to themselves. And then they just struggle and struggle and struggle for years. So that's a reason. And then it's like for men have always been raised to be tough and, you know, be guarded and not have feelings, not show emotion. And so when you have been taught that from the time you were three, if you were to fall down, you were told that you couldn't cry if your knee was bleeding, you know, and that's kind of instilled in you. So you go throughout life with that guard up. And then as life starts to life and you start to go through different things, you have never learned how to process, have connect with your emotions, to be honest with yourself that you have an emotion, because you've always been told not to. And so it's reasons like that why the stigma is there. But to the second part of your question, you asked how to change that and break that barrier.
Right. Yeah, but pretty big question, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that it's a great question because I believe that now we're coming to a place where mental health is more common and it's almost like a trendy thing, but I'm okay with it being a trendy thing because a lot of people need it.
Sure.
And a lot of people go with the latest trends. So if that's what it takes for you to get the support that you need, I'm with it. I'm in full support, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's more talked about. It's more socially acceptable. It's more accessible. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about Kirkwood Therapy is we do telehealth therapy. And with telehealth, you don't have to get a ride there because it's virtual. As long as you have a platform with a camera, you can get your access. You know, we take insurance. So if you don't necessarily have the money to pay for it, your insurance will cover it. And so I say all of that to say that, like, the stigma is changing,
right,
and the access is expanding as well for people to, you know, really, really dive into therapy.
That is it for today. Tune in Wednesday for Jennifer Rizzo Choi of the International Institute of Buffalo, Layton Jones from Irish City Action Buffalo, and John Torrey of Buffalo State University. This has been What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.